Welcome to the Republican Professor. I'm your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. It's Wednesday, 15 October 2015, years after Jesus, and we're talking about natural law and the Constitution. We're broaching the subject. It's been something I've been thinking about for a long time for the podcast. My natural law course at Claremont McKenna College with Professor Charles Kessler, a guest on this podcast, was in spring of 2016. Lots was going on at the time, and I ended up having a natural law angle for my dissertation just a few years later. The podcast did not go live until 2021. The first episode was on abortion. Big shocker. But there's been movement toward collating a natural law constitutional interpretation angle for some time, and I think we're just going to now make it explicit. This is going to be the first one in the playlist that I add to the playlist. I'm going to go back through the prior episodes and see which one is going to fit in that playlist. But we have a book called The New Right Versus the Constitution by Stephen Macedo. Stephen is still alive, I believe. I think he's at Princeton. I'm not sure if he's still alive. I'm not sure. He has the wrong definition of marriage, just FYI. So if you poke around, you're going to find that he believes that you can distort the definition of marriage in law. I don't agree with that, but this is a very thoughtful book, and I'm going to show you how to get to it. It's published by Cato Institute. Those of you who like cats will enjoy the Cato Institute because it's got the word cat in it. We got, let's see here. Yeah, we got the New Right versus the Constitution. The Cato Institute. I think I just searched in the search bar and this came up. If you click the PDF, it will not download for some reason. Let me just double check and see. Yeah, page not found. Okay, well, looks like they want you to download the ebook. And if you do that, I'm on an Apple computer. It will go into your books thing on your Apple computer. It's free. The Cato Institute is. It has a lot of good things about it. What I really like about the Cato Institute is they have a lot of money, apparently, and they give a lot away. They give a lot of stuff away for free without, they don't ask you for a donation. I mean, they obviously would invite you to have a donation. A little bit about this book, okay? I did not encounter this book in graduate school. I encountered this book in a Joan Didion book, and I'm not sure which one it was. I think it was After Henry. I know that I was reading that book about the same time I was thinking about this, and I bet if I searched that book, I just flipped through it a while ago this morning trying to find if I had made a connection there. I was like, is it that one or is it one of the essays? Anyway, I think it was After Henry, her book on After Henry. She just casually references him. That's where she talks a lot about 80s politics. And this guy, Stephen Macedo, comes up when Bork was getting borked. There's a conversation between Republicans on this. There's a split on Republicans on this. And Bork was on one side and natural law people were on the other side. And the questions are a little bit intricate, but we're going to get to all of it. Okay, we're not going to shy away from this. I noticed that Stephen Macedo doesn't say a damn thing about the right to keep and bear arms in this thing. And you can tell he probably has changing the definition of marriage in mind, which makes it more interesting. He's also on Richard A. Epstein's side as far as takings goes on private property and the power of eminent domain. That's a topic we're doing on this podcast. So we're swimming in these waters. And I happen to know, because I've met him and I've talked to him, Tom Palmer, DPhil from Oxford. I went to a seminar that he did in San Diego over a weekend that was funded by my former student, Ashton Trumbull's father, Thomas Trumbull, who is the chief executive officer and founder, I believe, of Leanin' Tree greeting cards, if you know that company. So the Leanin' Tree greeting cards guy sent me to Cato. He's a Cato guy. So I went there and I met Tom Palmer. Tom Palmer is a homosexual. I think he's from Ukraine. And he did a lot of the teaching, and he was a plaintiff in one of the prior cases, the lower court cases that became DC versus Heller in 2008 on the right to keep and bear arms. He wanted he gave sworn testimony of being attacked and using a handgun in self-defense in DC, I believe it was. And he wanted to be able to do that legally. And of course, it was almost impossible to get a permit. I mean, you couldn't even register a handgun for your own home. And his angle was the homosexual angle, I think. This is in the 80s. And then, he used it for self-defense. He used that testimony, I think it was reported in the Washington Post, basically start part of what became DC versus Heller, and then later the 2017 case, which we won, called the Griffith Court. Griffith, the Mormon guy, wrote the decision on the DC circuit. It was what was that? I'm going to look it up real quick.
Recording in progress.
Yeah, it was Wren versus DC. I knew I had 2017 Griffith of DC circuit. He was in the backstory of that as well. Well, anyway, Tom Palmer was with Cato. I don't know where he is now. But Cato has been kind of on the soft on immigration side and redefining marriage side, which we're against here. But they're good on economics, generally, economic regulation, and they have a track record for the Second Amendment. Even if Stephen Macedo, I can't find any trace of Second Amendment friendliness in here. But I'm just saying, if you're a Second Amendment person, you're going to not have to worry too much, at least on the at least at first. You don't have to worry about. So I'm just going to go through this, and I wanted to point out that this is made available for you, okay, on the Cato website. We'd like to thank Cato for publishing it, making it available for free, guys, for free. We'd like to thank Stephen Macedo for writing it. And he's going to go against Bork. Again, it's called New Right versus the Constitution. And it is an 80s debate. Yo, it's an 80s debate. there's a quote from Alexis Tocqueville. The strength of the courts of law has always been the greatest security that can be offered to personal independence. But this is more especially the case in democratic ages. Private rights and interests are in constant danger. And here he would say the right to redefine marriage is in constant danger. Private rights and interests are in constant danger if the judicial power does not grow more extensive and stronger to keep pace with equality of conditions. Macedo is arguing for a judicial activism, a judicial activism to go against untrammeled majoritarianism. Now, if he's a homosexual, and he might be, I don't know, he's sensitive to this because of the majoritarianism. Do you remember the moral majority, all that? Remember that in the 79, 80? Well, he felt like he didn't have a right to get married to another guy, I guess. Basically changed the definition of marriage so that that could be allowed. So he's sensitive to that. Second Amendment people are sensitive to it too, because look at, we're living in California. Just a few days ago, the governor tried to ban Glocks. This is one of the most famous handgun companies in recent decades. It's definitely fitting the common use test. And we have untrammeled majoritarianism right there. What is the role of the court? Now, I mean, ideally, you don't have a legislature that is so stupid and insane, but it does happen. And the founders were aware that it would happen. Ideally, you'd have an executive that would veto such crazy stuff, but the framers were allowed for that to happen too. What's the role of the courts? Well, he, according to Cato here, he proposes a principled judicial activism that interprets Constitution as a charter of liberties that protects individual freedom. Okay, so far so good. Yeah. He's going to go against Bork. If you don't know anything about Bork, that whole thing, you're going to learn. Bork was nominated by President Reagan, the most popular Republican president probably in American history. I think that's pretty safe to say. To be on the Supreme Court. Robert Bork was Borked, by, famously by the Senate Judiciary Committee. The way that Cato is billing that debate is as follows. During the Senate Judiciary Committee's hearings, oh, this is about Clarence Thomas. Okay, well, they tried to Bork Thomas. This might be a good. This is a good. I'm going to show you another book here. This is a book that I'm thinking about doing on the podcast called The Borking Rebellion. Jeffrey Lord, The Borking Rebellion. This is about what happened to. Judge Bork. It has to do with judicial activism versus judicial restraint. What is the proper role of the, what's the proper role of the judge? Are you bored yet? All right. Private rights and interests are in constant danger if the judicial power does not grow more extensive and stronger to keep pace with the equality of conditions. That's Alexis de Tocqueville. I'm going to go to the table of contents. We got the foreword from Richard A. Epstein. We're going to read that. We're going to read the preface, and then we'll get into Judge Bork. If you have any questions, just feel free to put them in comments. I don't know what would be appropriate for me if I can put this on the screen or not. I know that they've made this available for download, and I'm not sure that I want to shine it on the screen because, well, I think they want you to go to their website and they want you to click their little link there. So I think I'm just going to read it and go back and forth between my face and the reading of it. Forward. Stephen Macedo's monograph, The New Right versus the Constitution, contains a number of constitutional ironies. For decades, liberals and conservatives have been divided over the proper approach to constitutional interpretation. The standard liberal view has emphasized the openness of the constitutional text and the need to take changed circumstances into account in construing constitutional provisions. Liberated from the confining notion of original intent, judicial activism in support of fundamental values became the centerpiece of the liberal agenda. I think he means really the Democrat agenda. I'm going to put it that way. This is Richard A. Epstein right in the foreword. It culminated in the Supreme Court's most important decision, Brown versus Board of Education. That was written by a Republican, which ordered the end of de jure segregation in public schools. That's true. It contradicted the Democrats. I stand corrected. That's true. And far more controversial in Roe versus Wade. That was also written by a Republican, which constitutionalized women's right to abortion. That's true. It overturned the Democrat legislature in Texas. A Democrat dissented in that case, Byron White, and there was also a Republican that dissented, who later became Chief Justice. The conservatives have observed a different set of principles. In their view, the Constitution primarily established the rules for the operation of democratic institutions. The structural provisions of the Constitution thus dominate provisions intended to secure individual rights against the government. A presumption of judicial restraint was the result of this fundamental position. Well, the conservatives. You see how he's contrasting judicial activism with conservatism. I would just want to add here that in the Second Amendment context, judicial activism is usually called conservative. So it gets a little bit confusing here. these terms are not really well defined. I don't know if we should use these terms. You got to explain what you're talking about if you say the word conservative, if you say the word judicial activism. The problem of human nature is people like slogans and then they just end up throwing them around and then the kids pick them up. And there's not a lot of thought and careful attention to what these slogans are supposed to mean or if they mean anything. And I think it's just part of what we deal with as humans, where the slogans turn out to be quite harmful actually to dialogue. But you know, Richard is writing this, not me, so. Well, Macedo's essay is yet further evidence that the straightforward dichotomy between left and right, liberal and conservative, is now breaking down. This is in 1986 that he's saying this. Macedo is to be commended for bringing the librarian, oh, sorry, libertarian, natural rights tradition back to constitutional interpretation. I would just say Republican. That's what I would say. He launches a sustained attack on three basic conservative tenets. I don't like that word conservative. The doctrine of original intent, I think that's a mistake, which holds that the Constitution should be interpreted in accordance with the intentions of the framers who drafted and ratified it. Well, okay, if you think original intent is limited to intentions, fine. Okay, I'm going to keep going. The assumption that the Constitution organized a system of popular democracy and the view of judicial restraint that is said to follow from these two positions. Let's go through those again. Macedo's essay is yet further evidence that the straightforward dichotomy between left and right, liberal and conservative, is now breaking down. I wouldn't say it's breaking down. I would say it's being clarified. That's what I would say. Macedo is to be commended for bringing the libertarian, I would say Republican, natural rights tradition to constitutional interpretation. He launches a sustained attack on three basic conservative tenets. Again, the word conservative. You want to be careful about that. You don't want to have that thing hung around your neck if it's not Republican. If it's not a part of this natural rights tradition, you know? Are you guys following this? He launches a sustained attack on the doctrine of original intent. One. There's one. Which holds that the Constitution should be interpreted in accordance with the intentions of the framers who drafted and ratified it. Two, the assumption the Constitution organized a system of popular democracy. You're asking me why I'm writing this down. Well, it's because there's two types of students. I'm the real type. You're a fake type if you don't write it down. You're just along for the ride, but you're not learning anything. Three, the view of judicial restraint that is said to follow from these two positions. For Macedo, the limitations upon popular democracy are as much a part of the Constitution as the institutions of democracy itself. Accordingly, judges cannot indulge the easy presumption that legislation is constitutional unless the contrary is clearly shown. Instead, in each case, there has to be a neutral inquiry into how the provisions of a statute square with the language and structure of the Constitution. The invalidation of legislation is not some extraordinary event in the life of constitutional democracy. It's part of the original design. Okay. Where's my comment here? You like the original design. I like the word original there. Don't forget, we're not throwing out the original design, right? The target of Macedo's attack is noted conservative Robert Bork. That word conservative. See, this is where I'm getting to here, guys. Pay attention. There's a lot of people that are addicted to this term conservative, and they will never use the word Republican. It's almost like you're talking about an STD or something. I mean, why is the word conservative not used that way? I have the exact opposite reaction. I use the word Republican. I don't like the word conservative. It's too confusing. Now, maybe Republican is confusing for you too. Clearly, when people use the word conservative, they have a normative sense of what to conserve and what conservative means ideally. Well, you could say the same thing with using the word Republican. Couldn't you? That's what I do. And maybe it's just me. Accordingly, Richard A. Epstein continues in the foreword to Stephen Macedo's The New Right versus the Constitution. Accordingly, judges cannot indulge the easy presumption that legislation is constitutional unless the contrary is clearly shown. Instead, in each case, there has to be a neutral inquiry into how the provisions of a statute square with the language and structure of the Constitution. The invalidation of legislation is not some extraordinary event in the life of a constitutional democracy. It's part of the original design. In other words, there is no answer, prima facie, that judges should just lay down while the legislature does whatever the hell it wants, because they're the majority and judges are not. Judicial restraint. That doesn't follow from the original design. The original design implies an appropriate activism for judges. The only reason he has to go through all this stuff is because the 80s was so confused about judicial restraint versus judicial activism. The target of Macedo's attack is noted conservative Robert Bork, now on the circuit court for the District of Columbia, and frequently mentioned as a possible Reagan candidate for a future vacancy on the Supreme Court. Macedo also criticizes Attorney General Edwin Meese and Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights Bradford Reynolds. All right. We got some Republicans that are coming under his scrutiny. Is this an anti-Republican book? Let's find out. Macedo is clearly correct in rejecting the idea. I mean, look, I think we can agree that Reagan appointed a few knuckleheads on the Supreme Court. A lot of people would say that Kennedy was a knucklehead, at least sometimes, and that Sandra Day O'Connor was a knucklehead, at least sometimes. Maybe you want to switch a different word. Maybe you don't want to say knucklehead because that sounds like it's an all-encompassing term instead of selective. Selective knuckleheads, okay? Fine. Macedo is clearly correct, Richard A. Epstein continues, in rejecting the idea that the Constitution envisions an unfettered system of popular democracy. Yeah. The provisions protecting individual rights are entitled to a dignity equal to that of other parts of the Constitution. Although Macedo does not emphasize the point, I'm persuaded that the dangers of faction demonstrate the wisdom of entrenching individual rights against the state. Okay. The common perception that special interests are able to take over the legislature is all too true. As we've just seen in California with the anti-Glock special interests. The fear of faction, in turn, raises concerns as to both substance and process. Special interest legislation, for example, can direct government expenditures to a single group out of general revenue, and it can exempt certain groups from taxation. In each case, the unequal distribution of benefits and burdens is rightly perceived as fundamentally unfair. An elaborate effort to take from A and give to B, such legislation is an appropriate subject for judicial review. And there's a footnote here. My book, Takings, Private Property, and the Power of Eminent Domain, discusses the legal principles on which that review of taxation and other forms of government action should be undertaken. All right. Okay. I would also argue with Macedo that one has to be very cautious in dealing with the question of specific intent. Okay, good. Both he and Justice Brennan are correct in insisting that it is fruitless to interpret the general provisions of the Constitution solely with reference to the particular legislative abuses that prompted their passage. Fair enough. Macedo demonstrates anew how circumstances can undermine a theory of specific intent, understood as an effort to seek out the motivations of the framers. In other words, originalism, but not of intent only. Is that fair enough? He shows with great vigor the difficulties of ascertaining the constitutional intent when all that is available in the record is the inconsistent, ambiguous, and unreflective intentions of the large group of independent persons who participated in drafting or ratifying the Constitution. In this respect, the search for constitutional intent is no simpler than the more routine search for contractual intent in complex multi-party contract cases. The jurisprudential concern with intention has another more useful side, one that should not be discarded along with the vain quest for original intent. The invocation of intent can stand for the position that the text of the Constitution has to be the sole source of judicial authority. How are we doing on this? You enjoying this? I know I am. Let me show you how it looks on the Books app. I'm pulling it up. Yeah, let me show you that. Let's see, how can I point the books? I don't have books on my books app. Beside, this is the only one. So you click on it, and you can flip through. And this is what we're reading here. This one right here. We're on page. Well, it's got Roman numerals in my version. I think the original had Roman numerals. I think we're on this one. The judicial jurisprudential concern with intentions. The page numbering is different. Yeah, this is different. I don't like this page numbering. Well, this is what it looks like. The judicial ju jurisprudential concern with intention has another more useful side. The invocation of intent can stand for the position that the text of the Constitution has to be the sole source of judicial authority. For if the text cannot constrain unelected judges, then very little else can. Well, that makes sense, right? Right? We're looking for something that can restrain unelected judges. The elected officials can be restrained by, well, elections, assuming they want to be reelected, and also assuming we don't have these arbitrary term limits. When you put term limits in there, you take away the threat of unelect non if they want to be reelected, then they're going to want to do a good job. If you take that promise of a possibility of reelection away, then what are you going to restrain them with? Often it is useful, Richard continues, to assume that the Constitution means precisely what it says. What a concept. That the reason the Constitution protects freedom of speech or private property, for example, is that it says so. How refreshing. I'm going to add a note here. So refreshing, Richard. The text then provides the basis for a sustained analysis of the original provisions, which, as Macedo well understands, need not produce a crabbed or narrow interpretation. This theory of textual intent, moreover, places significant limitations upon the power of the courts to do what they will. Bork, Meese, and Reynolds, those are Republicans that are being criticized here, may be vulnerable insofar as they indicate a dominant role for popular democracy, but they are correct insofar as they rule out the idea of a living constitution. That's well said. That's well said. Yeah, good. They rule out a living constitution. See, a living constitution also doesn't restrain judges. That's good. So, in other words, he's saying the Republicans have some things right here, the Bork, Meese, Reynolds guys. They are correct in being against the living constitution. What they're saying is, Macedo and Epstein is, you need more than just to deny a living constitution. You need more. What's the problem with the living constitution? That allows judges to disregard the specific text. Why is it a problem to disregard the specific text? Because that's the part of originalism that we want to keep, the textualism. The Constitution means something, it means what it says, the text. How do you know what the text means? You got to go back to original sources. But those original sources cannot simply be that of intent, private intent. It's got to be publicly available for our jurisprudence. They are correct, the Republicans that Reagan appointed are correct, insofar as they rule out the idea of a living constitution that allows judges to disregard the specific text while searching for the contemporary underlying values of constitutional discourse. By the way, that guy Brennan was a disaster. And he was a Republican appointee, not the best. Without sound, textually based constitutional interpretation, the shape of the law becomes subject to competing value preferences. Macedo quotes Justice Brennan, that's the disaster that I just mentioned, Eisenhower appointment, Republican, unfortunately, but he was really a Democrat, man. I'm just saying. Macedo quotes Justin Brennan's well-known Georgetown speech to the effect that a theory of specific intent is inadequate guide to constitutional interpretation. But, and there's only one T, so don't get too excited here. But Brennan's alternative, his vision of an evolving constitution, bleh, cannot itself withstand scrutiny against a more traditional textual approach. Amen. Amen. As Macedo points out, Brennan and other liberal thinkers, they're kind of they have an inner Democrat they're channeling, either ignore or downplay property rights firmly grounded in the Constitution's text. See, this is what excites Epstein here. The issue of downplaying property rights, which are enforceable from the text of the Constitution, but are not enforced. They're not sufficiently enforced in an active way. There should be more judicial activism on that. You guys following that? Okay. Elsewhere in his speech, Brennan insists that the cause of human dignity is so powerful that the cruel and unusual punishment provision of the Eighth Amendment should be read as imposing a total and absolute prohibition on the death penalty. This position, however, is flatly inconsistent with the constitutional text. You see how this is going? The Fifth Amendment, passed in the same time as the Eighth, expressly states no person shall be. Well, what does it say? The Fifth Amendment states that no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment of indictment of a grand jury, nor shall any person be subjected to the same offense, shall be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, or shall he be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The three distinct references to the death penalty rule out the idea that the cruel and unusual punishment clause of the Eighth Amendment bans the death penalty in its entirety. You see how we're reading the Fifth along with the Eighth to talk about this, the death penalty? Right? You got to read them all together. And text controls. And that's an original provision. That's part of originalism, rightly understood. To allow a theory of an evolving constitution to undermine the text, he's continuing his criticism of the Republican Brennan, who's really a Democrat in disguise. To allow a theory of an evolving constitution to undermine the text is to substitute naked value preferences for law, the abuse traditional conservatives have so long condemned. There's that word conservative again. If you're sighing because this is difficult, yes. What's a traditional conservative? Isn't that just kind of like isn't the word traditional in the word conservative? But hey, you know, you do you. It is also an exceedingly dangerous practice because once it begins, it cannot be restrained. That's scary. You see the concern for wanting to restrain the government by restraining not only legislatures and executives, but judges. Judges, too, have to be constrained. We have a limited government, and that goes for all three branches of government. All are limited. The question here is, how are the judges able to do their part of limiting the other two excesses of the government, the executive and the legislative, while at the same time limiting themselves? What limits are there on the judicial power? You see how tricky it gets? But this is the topic. To allow a theory of an evolving constitution to undermine the text is to substitute, well, those limitations for non-limitations. If one were to argue, for example, that advances in penology and incarceration make the death penalty inappropriate, then someone else could argue that the rapid increase in the crime rate makes the use of torture appropriate, notwithstanding the constitutional prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. On the other hand, it is a far harder question whether the cruel and unusual punishment clause imposes any restriction on the invocation of the death penalty in some circumstances. That question is troublesome for any theory of interpretation. Constitutions, like well-drafted contracts, limit the domain of permissible choice, but they do not dictate the outcome in all cases. We need, therefore, some sense of the implicit background assumptions against which the Constitution was drafted in order to apply its provision to the questions that arise over time. It is here that Macedo's libertarian, I would say Republican, natural rights orientation should prove most instructive. natural rights. What does that mean? You see this term natural rights. What does that mean? Well, doesn't it imply natural law? Because the Constitution was drafted in the natural rights limited government tradition, see, in the natural rights limited government tradition, isn't that natural law? Modern commentators in that tradition will be among those best able to explicate the principles that make the document so great and enduring a human achievement. Macedo's excellent essay is an important contribution to putting constitutional interpretation back on a sound basis, one capable of sustaining the liberties that are the singular virtue of our republic. Richard A. Epstein, the University of Chicago Law School. This preface, I would like to thank the Cato Institute, this is from Stephen Macedo, for allowing me to add a substantial amount of new material to the second edition. Chapter 6 expands on the talk I gave at Cato's P Public Policy Day, 1987. And, there's a debate there with a Republican there. And he says he hopes the additional material helps advance the argument of the original monograph, but certainly more work needs to be done on the principled alternative to judicial jurisprudence of the new right. That project has been importantly furthered by several recent upcoming publications. And he mentions Takings there by Richard Epstein, which is what we're going through on the podcast. He gets the publication date wrong on that. It says 1986. It's actually 1985. The Rhetorical Presidency. I had to read that in graduate school. And that was forthcoming at the time. That's a good book. And Randy Barnett. Cool. Randy Barnett. All right. So we'll get to the introduction later. But here's an just a nice soft introduction to the issue of natural law and constitutional interpretation. And it gets a little bit dicey because because of the conflict there with the most popular president, the Republican president at the time, Ronald Reagan. All right. Well, thanks for joining me on the Republican Professor podcast. I've been your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. We have a reading from Psalm 61 and Streams in the Desert. We're doing the readings at different times during the episode. I did it in the middle last time. I'm going to do it at the end today. And probably the next one will do it at the beginning. Just trying different things. But let's have a spiritual reflection. I want to have a spiritual reflection every time. Situate this stuff. We're not just floating around. Psalm 61 is very short, so you atheists will like this one. Hear my cry, O God, attend unto my prayer. This is the King James Version. From the end of the earth will I cry unto thee. When my heart is overwhelmed, lead me to the rock that is higher than I. For thou hast been a shelter for me and a strong tower from the enemy. I will abide in thy tabernacle forever. I will trust in the covert of thy wings. Selah. For thou, O God, hast heard my vows. Thou hast given me the heritage of those that fear thy name. Thou wilt prolong the king's life and his years as many generations. He shall abide before God forever. O prepare mercy and truth which may preserve him. So I sing praise unto thy name forever, that I may daily perform my vows. Psalm 61, King James Version. Streams in the Desert is next. We have a reading from January 13th. Beachtown Books was where I purchased this 1925 edition. Kalman Publications, Las Vegas Station, Los Angeles. In all these things, we are more than conquerors through him that loved us. Romans 8:37. This is more than victory. This is a triumph so complete that we have not only escaped defeat and destruction, but we have destroyed our enemies and won a spoil so rich and valuable that we can thank God that the battle ever came. How can we be more than conquerors? We can get out of the conflict a spiritual discipline that will greatly strengthen our faith and establish our spiritual character. Temptation is necessary to settle and confirm us in the spiritual life. It is like the fire which burns in the colors of mineral painting, or like winds that cause the mighty cedars of the mountain to strike more deeply into the soil. Our spiritual conflicts are among our choicest blessings, and our great adversary is used to train us for his ultimate defeat. The ancient Phrygians had a legend that every time they conquered an enemy, the victor absorbed the physical strength of his victim and added so much more to his own strength and valor. So temptation, victoriously met, doubles our spiritual strength. Wow, that's a nice thought. I'm gonna read that again. Temptation, victoriously met, doubles our spiritual strength and equipment. It is possible thus not only to defeat our enemy, but to capture him and make him fight in our ranks. The prophet Isaiah speaks of flying on the shoulders of the Philistines, Isaiah 11:14. These Philistines were their deadly foes, but the figure suggested that they would not, they would be enabled not only to conquer the Philistines, but to use them to carry the victors on their shoulders for further triumphs. Just as the wise sailor can use a headwind to carry him forward by tacking and taking advantage of its impelling force, we're on page 15 at the top. So it is possible for us in our spiritual life, through victorious grace of God, to turn to account the things that seem most unfriendly and unfavorable, and to be able to say continually, the things that were against me have happened to the furtherance of the gospel. That's from Life More Abundantly. A noted scientist observing that early voyagers fancied that the coral-building animals instinctively built up the great circles of the atoll islands to afford themselves protection in the inner parts has disproved this fancy by showing that the insect builders can only live and thrive fronting the open ocean, and in the highly aerated foam of its resistless billows. So it has been commonly thought that protected ease is the most favorable condition of life, whereas all the noblest and strongest lives prove, on the contrary, that the endurance of hardship is the making of the men, and the factor that distinguishes between existence and vigorous vitality. Hardship makes character. A little bit more. Now thanks unto God, who always leads us forth to triumph with the Anointed One, and who diffuses by us the fragrance of the knowledge of him in every place. 2 Corinthians 2:14. Streams in the Desert, January 13th. Thanks for joining me on the Republican Professor podcast on 15 October 2015, years after Jesus. We will continue with the discussion of Stephen Macedo generally and specifically the issue of natural law and the Constitution in future episodes. We'll see you next time.